previously on Long Lost.
I'd like to make a plea to all you people to help us find our boys.
Sergeant Schultz, he's retired Minneapolis Parks Police. He had worked the case for quite some time.
I saw an injustice to the fact, in a bad conclusion, that the boys drowned.
He said, you know, I've been waiting years for somebody to call me and ask about this case.
I am 100% certain that on the river, I bit my house on it.
I'm Jack Elhai, and this is Long Lost, a new investigative history series from Twin Cities PBS.
What for you have been some of the high and low moments of your involvement?
Finding Sergeant Schultz. That was one of the big things that was that added a lot to the case. You know, somebody who had spoken to and interviewed some of these people that aren't around anymore, including the dad, Ken. He passed away, I think, in 2006, so we never got to meet him. Going and getting the books that Sergeant Schultz had saved of all of the old interviews and everything and the people that he had talked to and the names that answered some of the other questions that we had. It filled in some blanks. So that was definitely, it was like Christmas Day.
At last, deputies Jessica Miller and Lance Sauls had got their hands on the Klein brothers' files of Minneapolis Park Police investigator Jim Schultz. The pursuit for an answer in this difficult case took a sharp turn. For the first time in decades of searching for information, one investigator's findings had been passed on to other investigators. It was like a forensic handshake, a passing of a torch. Schultz had hoped for years that this would happen.
I'm assuming, maybe I'm wrong, that it's been a while since you've thought a lot about this case.
Yeah. I, when I retired, I kind of put it on my mind.
Yeah. Do you remember the time or the moment when you first became aware of the Klein case?
I'm sure that I learned of the case by watching something, I think on Channel 4, done by Carolyn Lowe. Carolyn was a reporter assigned to cover police cases, and she did a special on this case. And in watching that, I learned that three boys disappeared from Farview Park in 1951 and were ruled drowned. And I thought, I should look into this case. Remember, I assigned cases. So I had the capability of looking at the case. And I spent some time looking at it, not full time, but when time allowed, I looked at that case.
You gave a lot of your materials to Jessica Miller?
What does she have of mine? Because I can't find my material.
Oh, well, what I've seen that she has of yours is a lot of interview transcripts, mainly.
Super.
So interviews you did with Betty and Kenneth?
They got the transcripts, but they don't have the tape.
Not that I know of.
I think they've been destroyed.
You know, clearly you were very interested and invested in the story and wanted to make progress in it. And when you began looking at this, it was already 40 years or so past the disappearance of the boys. What did you hope to accomplish?
It was possible that the person that took the boys could still be arrested. It's a Farview Park case, I thought, and I'm a park police officer assigned to investigation. I thought I could help the family. I don't know how much time I spent on it, but I met, I believe, all the Klein brothers that are living, and I met the parents.
Of course, I interviewed the parents because it's pretty standard that, well, maybe the parents were responsible or knew something they hadn't told the police yet. So that's pretty standard to do that.
Today, in missing child investigations, family members are always scrutinized early on. But no one had done that in 1951. When Schultz asked Kenneth Klein in 1998 whether Betty could in some way be responsible, Kenneth responded with an astonished silence and then with, "Heavens!" The idea of it was ridiculous to him. Then Schultz pressed Kenneth on whether he had something to do with the boy's disappearance. "Heavens no," came out of Kenneth's mouth again. Schultz asked why he should believe that. Kenneth gave a spirited self-defense, pointing out he was proven to have been at work when the boys disappeared. "I was on the job all the time," he said. When Schultz asked Betty about Kenneth's possible role in the disappearance, she was equally incredulous. He loved the boys too much to harm them in any way, she said. Kenneth had quit drinking years before the brothers went missing, and he spent all his free time with them, boating, fishing, and going out junking with them. He was a devoted father. Deputies Jessica and Lance read those parts of Schultz's interviews closely. They, too, had considered the possibility of the parents' involvement.
You're correct. That's one of the first places that you look. We did. We looked. Unfortunately, Ken Sr. had passed away by the time we got involved, so I never got a chance to meet him. But I read through old interviews and reports that were done at the time with him, involving Betty, their extended family, grandparents, that kind of thing. Just the effort that they put in themselves and the repeated attempts to go get this case opened and not accepting this answer that they were given all the way up until their deaths. And just their behavior, making birthday cakes, buying them presents still, celebrating those milestones that were happening even though they weren't there. They spent every extra penny they had on searching, whether it be to schools, to other states. So maybe we saw them in a crowd on a TV, you know, footage in the background. And they'd go and they would check that out and call those places. On their own, they had these age progression drawings done. That is not behavior over that long of a period of time of family members who were involved. They had been directly asked about that and questioned in that. And there was never any indication that was a possibility.
It had crossed my mind, too, when I first met Betty and Kenneth Klein in 1998, that perhaps they had something to do with the boys' disappearance. That question didn't linger for long. They both seemed so earnest, so determined, so pained when they talked about their missing sons. And of course, they both had strong alibis for the time the boys vanished. Kenneth at work and Betty at home with Gordon. That should have led the police to question or consider other people as possible suspects. But the police in 1951 were not persuaded a crime had even occurred.
So when they shut down the investigation, they didn't really go back and question anybody that I'm aware of.
There's no mentions of suspects in any of the reports at the time. And I think the closest thing there was to that was there was an area somewhere down by the industrial area by the river where there was people that were working in the area, but basically homeless and were kind of living along the bank there in an area. And they had kind of moved all of those people out, talked to a couple of them, but nothing ever came of it. That was probably the closest to anything suspect-related at the time.
But there would be a lot suspect-related in Jessica and Lance's investigation. As a writer covering this case, I encountered an ethical question here in discussing suspects. Nobody had ever been charged with a crime in connection with the Klein brothers' disappearance. And indeed, the original investigation did not determine that a crime had occurred. Under these circumstances, should I name the names of the suspects Jessica and Lance identified? If I were a journalist covering a contemporary crime, the answer would be no. Naming uncharged suspects can irreparably damage their reputations, livelihoods, and relationships. But the Klein case is not a contemporary investigation, it's a historical one. The boys disappeared in 1951, a time when the Minneapolis police never seriously considered that the boys were victims of foul play. Any suspects would likely be dead, leaving them with little to be harmed by the disclosure of their names.
One of the great things you were able to do is develop a list of suspects, which hadn't happened before.
Yeah, we have quite a list of suspects. It's hard to rule people out at this point, and probably the majority of them are deceased.
And at the top of the list was Lloyd Paddock. What leads you to believe that he is a suspect?
Well, he was around the area at the time. He lived nearby. He knew who the boys were. He exhibited some odd behavior, you know, during the time when they went missing. and that kind of caught the attention of other people that lived in the area a little bit, that he was doing repairs in his home and adding a concrete floor to his basement.
The clue that we got from a lady that lived right across the street, so she said one day she watched her neighbor come home with a whole bunch of concrete bags. And she said, I asked him, what are you going to do with all that concrete? And he said, I'm going to finish my basement floor because it's all dirt. And this is right at the time these boys disappeared.
And when he had prearranged for people to come over to help, you know, that next morning, and these people show up to help him, and he says, no, I don't need your help. I did it. I already did it. You know, which would have meant that he had stayed up all night long to pour concrete in his basement. You know, and back in the 1950s, it's not like you just ordered the cement truck to come and pour it in there. You know, it was mixing several batches. I've talked to some people that have been in the concrete business for a long time. And they said for one person to do that, even in a whole night, that would have been really hard work. And I don't know if you would have been able to finish it. And then later that same night, the wife of one of the gentlemen that went over to help him had asked this guy if he was going to come out and look for the boys, if he was going to join the search. And he made a comment that they're not worth looking for. She thought that that was just rather an odd thing to say, you know, at the time. And he had a truck with the wood planks in the bed. And she, the same woman, had said, there's nothing wrong with those planks in the back of that truck. They weren't that old. And he just replaced them all out of the blue. And she thought that was odd. And, you know, years later, thinking back, she said that this guy was just kind of a strange guy. And she just had a feeling that there just wasn't something right about him. So it's just, you know, statements like that and behavior like that right at that time is just kind of stands out.
It's primarily what we have is hearsay, you know, involving him. But there was enough people that remarked about it where he stayed in the records, where we could still find him, find information on him.
Did you have a chance to look at any other cases, any other missing child cases that might be connected to this, kids who disappeared at around the same time?
One of our suspects was a man named Fossey, who was a park worker at Fairview Park.
The boys knew him, and he, my understanding is he was kind of an equipment person, so you could go there, and there was a warming house there, you know, if it's skates, or he would take them to the sledding hill and that kind of thing.
After the Klein boys had gone missing, he left the area, and in 1955, admittedly, provided it is the same person, time does change and records do change, but he would have come up again in 1955, being involved with the Schuster-Peterson, I think it was, case.
A case in Chicago where three boys were killed. They were older than the Klein boys. This park worker, the Chicago PD were investigating, and they found out that he was working at a horse stable down in the area, and it was the owner of that horse stable that was eventually convicted of the deaths for killing those three boys, and that this park worker was involved in the cleanup of the scene and hiding, you know, after the fact and just getting the bodies out of there. But that's as much involvement as he admitted to her that they were able to prove at the time. And they did, the Chicago did send officers up to Minnesota at the time to investigate him just because we had three boys that disappeared up here a year prior before he left and went down there.
I've always kind of thought it was somebody that worked at Fairview Park that was involved in it. But then again, you go back, the ones we knew, even back then, the people that worked at the park, to us as kids, they were part of the police department. That's the way we looked at them, because they were with the city, and the city is the police, and you know what I mean. So I just think it was an opportunity, and they were there, and they'd been looking at them, and that's what I think. They took them, and they got sold.
Both our number one and number two suspects knew the boys. They were around in that area. And it would have been, they would have been people that they would have been used to seeing and probably had some trust in, and so could have gone off with them somewhere.
That Chicago case was finally solved after 40 years, but with no implication of the Minneapolis suspect or connection to the Klein brothers' disappearance. Both cases shared similar problems: ambiguity, frustrated families, and early assumptions later doubted. The main assumptions in the Klein case that Farview Park should be a focus of the investigation and that the boys ended up at the Mississippi River may have derailed the original investigation in 1951. Jim Schultz and I examined a map of the path the tracking dog followed in purportedly tracing the course of the brothers after they left home for the park. We talked about other possibilities of where the boys may have walked.
And I've always thought, well, the kids would walk down here, down there to the park.
Right, yeah.
That's not what they did, I don't think. I wouldn't have done that when I was 8. I would have taken the shortest route.
Which is 3 yards? And
through the yards. Mm-hmm. I did it as a kid. I went through yards. I probably spent more time walking through people's yards than I did on the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. If you took the shortest route, within about 500 feet, you would have been at the house that had the floor re-cemented. It's a straight line to Farview Park, almost a straight line. As birds fly, that's the direction they'd take. I'm not sure that they ever were on the sidewalks.
That's possible, because no one knows that they even got to the park.
No one saw them in the park. I don't think they made it to the park.
Yeah.
Somebody should have seen them in the park, I think.
We just traveled around the neighborhood with all the rest of the kids. There was a lot of people. I mean, you know, it's like anything else. You have neighbors, you have these. We had the paper stand down at the end, you know, where everybody picked up their newspapers. You know, I mean, there was any number of people that we knew and talked to. We didn't know them, you know, personally or in a way that you'd jumped in a car with them or something like that, but you knew them. You knew who they were. I think about the rumors and things like that. You know, the one guy on the path where we used to go down to the park by, you know, walk by his house, and how they never did anything to check that place out.
So many unanswered questions, so many possibilities of what happened to the boys. And it's impossible to disprove that the boys ended up in the Mississippi River. It's unlikely, but it could have happened. Beyond our two main suspects, there's a rich assortment of other possible fates of Kenneth Jr., David, and Danny Klein. A few days after the brothers vanished, the Kleins received a postcard in the mail. It was written in an oddly elaborate script in blue ink, and it said, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Klein, I suppose you are worrying about your 3 children who disappeared Saturday. Don't worry, they will be all right if you raise $15,000 by Tuesday, November 20th. If you don't raise the money by November 20th, we will have to dispose of your 3 children. If you want your 3 children, drive out on Highway 169 at 11 p.m., 10 miles north of Princeton, Minnesota. You will then see a blue Ford by the roadside. Inside will be your 3 children. If you have the $15,000 with you, they will be yours. Don't try any tricks." Here, the Minneapolis field office of the FBI became involved. Agents surveyed the area near Princeton, about 70 miles from Minneapolis, and made plans to apprehend whoever might try to pick up the ransom. On the night of November 20th, after the Minneapolis police had closed their investigation, Kenneth Klein set off for the drop-off spot, along with several FBI agents and other law enforcement officers, discreetly trailing. It's not known whether he had the ransom money with him. Nobody ever appeared at the spot designated in the postcard. This ransom request never inspired the Minneapolis police to reopen the case, and indeed Minneapolis law enforcement may not have even known about it. As a result of this fragmented communication, the Klein family fell victim once again, this time to an uncoordinated investigation. 5 years later, a family acquaintance, Leonard Lidholm, became involved in the case. A car mechanic, Lidholm expressed outrage over the Minneapolis police's handling of the investigation. He seems to be the first person to raise a possibility that Betty and Kenneth dared not mention that the boys had been murdered. Lidholm alleged that a male neighbor of the Kleins had often met with the Klein brothers and sometimes took them to a cave on the banks of the Mississippi River.
And then there are a couple of times when, like at the bottom of the second page, Kenneth searches the muddy riverbank caves. I don't know if it was this incident, but he said he found some toys that he thought belonged to his son. And another time, maybe this is when Lidholm was involved, they found some catechism, some other items.
Yeah, Lidstrom searches a cave that the boys went to.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As we said before, that there was camps along that river, and there was kids that played along that river, and it was kind of a playground.
Then, around 2004, Betty and Kenneth hired a private investigator to look into the case. The private investigator believed that the brothers had been lured by two men who lived in the neighborhood. He heard about these men from a woman terminally ill with cancer who wanted to tell him what she knew about the boys before she died. On the day the brothers disappeared, she said, she saw three boys playing basketball with the two men. The private investigator judged the woman genuinely truthful.
Did they ever, your parents ever tell you if they suspected somebody in the neighborhood being responsible?
You know, yeah, because they'd been told different things by different people and different leads. And I think in the end, it got very confusing for them too, to try to sift through. But I think also they realized that until the police would get involved, they really had not much chance of solving the crime on their own. But there was a neighbor that was said to have been a pedophile, and the police knew it. What can you do, you know? It's like watching a guy run a red light. What are you going to do about it? You can't run over there and give him a ticket. If you try to do a citizen's arrest, he'll probably punch you out, you know? You can have your theories and you can have your gut feelings, but unless law enforcement gets behind you, you can't do anything. It's like right now. They might be in the basement of that house down there, but where's the backing? Where's the BCA? Where's the FBI?
There's a lot of things that could have happened to your brothers.
Oh, yeah.
Many possibilities. Do you think the possibility that you seem to take most seriously, which is that they were abducted and then sold ended up in other families, do you think that's the best of the possible outcomes?
Well, I think that's the best, but I think that is the outcome. I believe that 100%. I don't know if they're still alive for sure today or not, because they're, you know, I'm not brand new anymore either. So I do truly believe that. I don't think they were taken and drowned. I don't think they drowned. That just doesn't even make sense to me. They wouldn't have went there without me, period.
When I spoke with Elizabeth a long time ago, they were all talking a lot then about child adoption rings in the 1950s, kidnapping children and sending them to illegally adoptive families. Do you know if that was something going on, really going on back then?
We don't. If there's something like that, they don't keep good records of where the kids come from or where they would go. At one point in time, Mike and Gordy were working together and on this case, and they said, well, we found there's a high number of kids that went missing around those years, you know, the 1950 to 55, 56. And they felt that there was a spike. And what would explain that, I really don't know. And we're not discounting that could have been a possibility, because, you know, we can't. So we have to leave it open until we can close it off, and we don't have enough information to do that. So to say that it's impossible, no, it very well could have been possible that they were taken and given to another family or split up.
So here we are now, so many years later. What are some of the possibilities of ways in which this case could be resolved?
I think that the avenues that we have available to follow, and we have information and interviews and some facts to back up, I think that they need to be followed. You know, attempts to get into that house and looking more into the park and doing a search there, you know, if the park worker was involved. There were rumors that they were buried under the grandstand. Well, you have to find old maps and find where that was and go and, you know, take a look and see what can be found. But, you know, things like that that can be done, I think they need to be done. There's an avenue to follow. It needs to be done so that we can answer that question and either have a resolution or we close it off that, nope, that's not where they are, that's not what happened, and then move on to the next. The family, they had a box. And there were two hats that were recovered that the parents identified as belonging to two of the boys. And they had saved these things for years. Everything the private investigator had done and all of his interviews that he had done, information he had gathered was in that box. Some other belongings of the boys were in that box. And it's missing. And we haven't been able to find it. I think that it was probably stolen, but it's gone. And there could be a wealth of information in there. And with technology, you know, we would have the ability to do some tests on those hats, you know, and find out what's in them, where have they been, and maybe answer some of those questions. And it's heartbreaking that we can't do that. It's our one piece of physical evidence that we know exists somewhere, and it's out of reach. So that's been a big obstacle and very sad for them to lose that, something they held on to for so long, and now it's gone.
Where was that box last known to be?
It was last known to be out and in use when they were working with the private investigator. And I think he ended somewhere between 2004 and 2006. And they had taken everything that he turned over to them and put it in that box. And it was put away at the home in Monticello.
So it's been a good long while now that it's been missing.
Yes.
Within the Klein family, there's disagreement over what really happened to the box. While Jessica places it last with Betty and Kenneth in Monticello, some members of the family say it was last seen in the possession of Gordon or other siblings. So much could ride on what may have been in that box. In the years after the boys' disappearance, however, more serious divides would widen within the family, and these would have a lifelong effect.
On the next episode of Long Lost.
There was boxes full of stuff, even the caps, and it all disappeared.
Gordy and I have two different ideas on who knows what.
Even the family knows they're different. They've been affected by this.
Gordy seemed to be separate.
It's almost like a two families.
Long Lost is the production of Twin Cities PBS, written by Jack L. High and produced by Katie O'Rourke. Original music by Robert L. High. Audio engineering by Terry Gray. Additional sound by Eric Poggle, Joe Demko, and Johnny Hagen. Managing director Brendan Heenahan. Executive producer Daniel Pierce Bergen. Production manager Ted Hink and production coordinator Anne Guttridge. Special thanks to the Minnesota Historical Society and KSTP Archives, and the University of Minnesota Press, publisher of Jack L. High's new book about the Klein case, The Lost Brothers. Funding for this podcast was made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and Friends of Minnesota Experience. You can reach us at longlost@tpt.org and visit us at tptoriginals.org/longlost to learn more about the case.